Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Jack Kelly. He's the author of a new book on an important piece of Central New York history, and American history for that matter. It's titled Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal. Jack is a journalist, novelist, and historian. His previous works include the book Band of Giants, The Amateur Soldiers Who Won America's Independence. Jack, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Grant.
Start with a basic question. Tell me about how the decision to build the Erie Canal was made.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the idea can be traced back to one man in one time in the spring of 1805. The idea of the canal had been floating around for years, but a man named Jesse Hawley, who was a flour broker and tried to make money shipping flour back from Western New York to the markets in the East, suddenly came up with this idea. If he could tap the water of Lake Erie, drain it down to the Hudson River, it would provide an artificial river that would tremendously reduce the cost of shipping. And as it turned out, he was right about that. He was also right about the pretty much where the route would go and the cost even.
So. Well, yeah, and I wanted to pick up on that last piece because can you give me some sense of what a public infrastructure project today would be if it were of similar significance to what the Erie Canal was back then? What would we be talking about today?
Well, I think as far as significance went for the country, there's very little to compare. I mean, there are, of course, much bigger projects, the Interstate Highway System, the Hoover Dam. But as far as the impact on the country, the Erie Canal was far and away the greatest public works project ever completed in the country. As far as cost goes, some estimates, if you had to dig it again today using the labor that they had, it would be about $187 billion. Hmm. It actually cost about $7 million in the dollars of 1825.
And what were the biggest challenges in the actual building of the canal?
Well, I think the planning was probably the biggest thing. Is you have to understand that when you dig a canal, it has to be absolutely level. It's not just approximately level, because when the water comes in, it will set the level absolutely. So the surveyors who laid out the plan of the canal had to be precise over 100 miles to within inches. And that was a level of precision that was really unknown in that time, in the early 19th century. And it was just absolutely necessary, in addition to designing locks, in addition to designing aqueducts over the rivers that they had to cross. Every little stream had to have a culvert so the stream could go underneath the canal. And there was the biggest challenge was at Lockport, which is out in western New York, where they had to go up a 60-foot cliff, and that required designing a whole new concept of locks, where each lock opened to the next, and they had a series of five locks to take it up that cliff.
One of the things that you talk about in your book, and it's easy for us to forget now, given that we live in this area and it's well settled, is just how much of this was still frontier that they were building this through.
Yes, absolutely. Particularly out here in Syracuse and farther west, it was very, very lightly settled. And one of the problems that arose from that was that there was nobody to work on the canal. Hmm. In the eastern Mohawk Valley, which was quite a bit more settled, a lot of farms out there, they could hire farm laborers, and people would take off matter of months and work on the canal, but they weren't about to follow the canal as it went out west. So that was where it came to importing mostly Irish laborers from New York City and then laborers that came over from Ireland and went out and worked on the canal in the west.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Jack Kelly, the author of a new book on the Erie Canal titled Heaven's Ditch. This may be a dumb question I'm going to ask anyway, because it struck me as I was reading some of the stuff in the book. In the construction, was there one final moment, when the when the water rushed in or met in the middle or something equivalent to the last spike being driven into a railroad, which is this, you know, iconic picture that a lot of us have in thinking about big projects and settling the frontier.
Well, there wasn't – it wasn't quite as dramatic as that, and it wasn't so graphic. But when they completed what was called – after they constructed the locks that went up to the top of the cliff, where it was actually a Niagara escarpment, the cliff that Niagara Falls goes over at Lockport, they had to cut through solid rock for about 7 miles, and that had a 30-foot ditch in order to keep the level of the canal at the same level as Lake Erie. And it was that was the last bit that came together. It was very, very difficult, very hard rock. And all they had to blast in those days was gunpowder. And so they had to drill holes down in, blast it, remove the rubble. And when they got that ditch finally completed, they call it the deep cut, the canal was finished.
And tell me a bit more. You mentioned this earlier, but I'd like to hear a bit more about the impact at the time of this project on the economy of the nation, the economic development of the nation, and then also the economy of upstate New York.
Well, the great obstacle to shipment of all resources from the interior, of course, was the Appalachian Mountains. And the only gap through those mountains was where the Mohawk River flowed through. But the Mohawk River was an unreliable, not really navigable river in those days. So once they broke through with the canal, once things could be shipped down, I think the cost dropped by a factor of 100. And so Western New York was a much more fertile area for growing wheat than was New England. And so a lot of wheat and flour. Rochester became the greatest flour milling city in the world. And then once you reach Lake Erie, the rest of the Great Lakes are on the same elevation. So you could have boats coming down. They had steamboats by the time the Erie Canal was finished. There were steamboats could come down from what's now Minnesota or from Chicago area and easily come down to New York. So you had resources like lumber and coal, iron ore kept coming down the canal. And it changed upstate New York. It changed New York City tremendously because having that huge area to draw on, New York City became the greatest port in America. So it was the financial and commercial impact was tremendous.
And so after this is built, along the way, we have the continuing of a transportation infrastructure and, you know, the country has different ways of moving goods. And so when does the impact of the canal – this may be a hard thing to get around, but when does the impact of the canal kind of begin to fade and when does it, you know, become less important?
Well, the interesting thing is that the first passenger railroad was actually built from Albany to Schenectady to serve passengers on the Erie Canal. That was the first passenger railroad in the country. And so as the canal had just been finished, the railroads started to come in. Gradually, they took over. But the Erie Canal was very successful financially through the 19th century. It came to the 20th century. The state had to decide whether to enlarge it and modernize it, which they decided to do. It was another huge expense. And they made it what's now the barge canal. But as soon as the barge canal was finished, traffic began to drop off. And the final blow was the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway in 1959, which allowed ocean-going ships to come down into Lake Ontario through the Welland Canal in Canada to Lake Erie, and then on to all the Great Lakes. And that was pretty much the death knell for the Erie Canal as far as a commercial waterway.
Now, what new inventions do you think can be tied to the canal? You make this argument that a lot of different things are related to this canal of all sorts. But what about new inventions?
Well, I think one of the most prominent ones was the invention of waterproof cement. When they started digging the canal, the commissioners had no idea where they were going to get the cement that would hold up in the locks and in the various aqueducts and so forth that needed a cement that would withstand water. Most cement was just lime and sand. So they had a gentleman, actually another amateur scientist up in around Rome, New York, experimented with different types of rocks and found a vein of limestone in the Chittenango area that was could be cooked down to into waterproof cement, and that was a huge impact. The same vein of limestone runs down into the Hudson Valley. It was mined there for the Brooklyn Bridge, which is 1886. So,
you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Jack Kelly. He's recently written Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal, and we've been talking about that book. Now, in your book, you tie the canal to the emergence of some interesting national personalities of the time. Tell me about a couple of your favorites.
Well, one interesting personality, I think interesting connection that I bring out in the book, there was a gentleman named Sam Patch who was the first professional daredevil in America. And you say, well, what does that got to do with anything else? But Sam Patch went around jumping over waterfalls, and sometimes he would jump from the masts of ships. And people in Rochester, he had a crowd of 10,000 people came to see him, which was unprecedented crowd in the rather remote areas of that time. And he jumped over the falls of the Genesee successfully, and so he decided to do it again, got another big crowd, jumped over, and he never came up. The city fathers were so outraged and shocked by this event that they invited the greatest revival preacher of the day, who was a man named Charles Grandison Finney, to come and do a revival of religion in the city of Rochester. Finney came there in 1830, and he set off one of the greatest revivals of religion in the entire country, in the country's history. Really has an impact even today, the kind of evangelical religion that he really was the spark for.
Do you have one special hero that you have found in that's related to this story of the canal, and maybe one worst villain?
You know, I have a lot of admiration for, and I happen to grow up in the next town over from Palmyra, New York, which is in Wayne County, a little farther west of here, of Joseph Smith, who founded the Mormon religion in that town of Palmyra. I'm not a Mormon myself, but I, in reading about him and his history, and a lot of people don't realize that Mormon religion was formed on the canal. It always associated with Utah. But he was one of the most imaginative people of the 19th century in any field, practically, and certainly in religion. He was a person who, from scratch, came up with a scripture, with a structure for a church, and it's a church that continues today, 15 million people, believers. So quite, you know, a very interesting character, whatever you feel about the religion itself. It's hard to say about villains. I can't offhand think of too many villains, but you know, I think a lot of the people that came up here, there was a lot of unusual people, and they were sincere. They were really looking for truth, and they were looking for sometimes their own very strange take on the truth.
Now, in the title of your book is Murder, and you write about America's first quote unquote crime of the century, and you tie that to the canal. So tell us about that crime.
Yeah, well, I don't want to give away too much, Grant.
Save a little bit. Tell us something.
But there was a gentleman named William Morgan who lived in Batavia, up not right on the canal, but near the canal. Probably worked on the canal. He was a bricklayer, and he had been a Freemason. He had a run-in with the Freemasons. They threw him out. He wrote a book revealing all their secrets, which he had sworn an oath, as all Masons swear an oath not to reveal his secrets. And so he was kidnapped. He was taken to Fort Niagara, which is up on Niagara River in Lake Ontario, and he disappeared. Now, what his fate was is still very much a mystery, but it set off a frenzy of hatred of Freemasons. And a lot of people in upstate New York were very concerned that the Freemasons were going to institute an aristocracy in America. And so they became – it was a kind of a paranoia, a conspiracy theory type of thing of those days. But it grew into a political movement. It was the original third party in American politics. They ran a candidate for president. And apropos of the current campaign season, was the anti-Masonic party that invented the presidential nominating convention for the 1832 election. They didn't – their candidate only won one state, which was Vermont, and they faded out quite soon afterwards. But they had an impact as our original third party.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Jack Kelly. Going back to the infrastructure piece, public officials and politicians in this area of New York, when they talk about the need for more attention to infrastructure today, and it's a topic that, you know, we've heard in this presidential campaign as well, they often point to the Erie Canal and they want to use that as their touchstone. Do you think that there are lessons for the discussions that we're having today about these kinds of issues and projects? Or was that then and this is now? It's a different thing.
No, I think absolutely there are lessons. I think the two lessons that I would point to is, first of all, the Erie Canal was so successful that just in tolls in later years when the canal had matured, in 1 year the tolls were equal to the entire cost of building the original canal. That's how successful it was. And so the message that that sends is these people had the gumption and the foresight to invest into something that paid huge dividends. And the fact that we're not doing that now is somewhat of a mystery. But the sort of the other lesson I think to pay attention to is because of the success of the Erie Canal, many other canals were built, not only in New York State, but in other states up and down the country. Most of those were failures. Most of them never made money. They became kind of pork barrel projects, and a lot of them were just a waste of money because, as I mentioned earlier, the railroads were coming in. The railroads were much cheaper to build, they're cheaper to operate, cheaper to maintain, and they ran year-round, which one of the big drawbacks of a canal is it has to be closed down, at least in the northern states, had to be closed down in the winter. So there was an enthusiasm for canals that was not properly thought out, but I think that the sort of courage that people had, and it took a lot of courage for New York State to invest in the Erie Canal. It took a huge portion of the entire capital in the state to build it. That courage paid off, and I think it's a lesson that politicians could pay attention to today.
What about the physical remnants of the canal? I mean, it's still there. We can see it in this area. Do you think that as a historical place is being properly preserved? Is it being allowed to be lost and deteriorate? What's your view on this, having spent so much time thinking about it and writing about it?
I think that what is left of the canal is very much needs to be preserved. You see some beautiful stonework, and it's hard to imagine when every stone had to be moved with horsepower and manpower and cranes and set in place, cut by hand to fit into these locks that you see up and down the canal. So I think it's the type of thing that gives a sense of life at that time that is invaluable. There's not too many remnants of the original, what they call Clinton's Ditch, which was the 4 foot deep ditch, was the original Erie Canal. There's a few scraps of that here and there. Most of the stonework you see is from what they call the Enlarged Canal, which was built in around the 1840s and 50s. And then, of course, the Barge Canal, which is what most people associate with the Erie Canal now, is quite a radical departure from the original canal. The entire eastern end of the Erie Canal was abandoned when they built the barge canal, and they made the Mohawk River into a canal. So and that's where you see a lot of the old stonework from the canal was just abandoned. It sits off in fields, and they have one on the thruway. There's a little park now that's got some of the stonework from the canal.
Now, you've written about a lot of different things. Why did you decide to devote this much time to writing a book about the Erie Canal? How did that come about?
Well, I think the seed for it was in my childhood. You know, when I was a kid, there were still barges went through the canal, and I used to watch them go through the locks, and it was sort of a magical procedure to see this huge vessel enter the lock and then raise up and go out at a higher level. We used to drive by Hill Cumorah, which was where Joseph Smith had found the golden plates they turned into the Book of Mormon. So it was a trip down to, you know, to my roots in a lot of ways, and it was just something that, you know, I think these things stick in your mind, and sooner or later you turn to them and deal with them.
And how'd you go about writing the book? Did you have a particular plan of attack or research method?
The research was, I won't say I had a plan of attack for the research, but the difficulty in writing it was I wanted to deal with a lot of different diverse people and religious and political movements. And the difficulty, in which I hope I've succeeded somewhat at least, is to weave all those things into a story and show the relationships of the people. And there were some interesting connections in that William Morgan's, the man I mentioned who was kidnapped by the Masons, his wife ended up being one of the wives of Joseph Smith just by pure coincidence. So it was the different stories did weave together a little bit.
And finally, just the title itself. I mean, you mentioned Clinton's Ditch a few minutes ago, but where does Heaven's Ditch come from? What's the origin of that phrase?
I dreamed that up myself, actually. Clinton's Ditch, of course, referred to DeWitt Clinton, who was a great champion of the canal back in the days when it was built. And I wanted to bring in the idea of the religious and spiritual upheaval developed along a canal. So I came up with Heaven's Ditch.
Oh, that's a great title. I had just assumed that it was a phrase that had come in the press at the time in talking about this project. That was Jack Kelly, and again, the title of his new book is Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal. Jack, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Grant. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.